year after year, and sometimes it seems like day after day, we generate ever more data, and our data is collected and analyzed by ever more parties. Our smartphones, our smart devices, our social media accounts, our web browsing, our entertainment choices, our online shopping habits. So many aspects of our lives are digitally recorded, stored, and scrutinized, and sometimes without our explicit knowledge or consent. The Supreme Court has repeatedly upheld an implicit right to privacy based on the Fourth and the 14th Amendments, but the landscape of privacy is rapidly changing with data collection on this scale, both by private enterprise and by governments. And exactly what data is being collected about us, when, by whom, and for what purposes is often unclear, even to savvy technology consumers and to digital natives. If we're unclear about what data is being collected about us and what it is being used for, can we really have an understanding of what is private and what is public? So today we're going to dig into some of the many issues surrounding data, privacy, and how much control we have over our personal information. Welcome to this installment of We'll Fix It in Post.
So today we've been thinking as a group a lot about this, like, this weird dynamic between, like, you know, our smart technology, like even our, like, smartphones or like our Alexas and our Google Homes, and like how much data collection is actually going on, and like where is the line that we draw. And one of the weirdest things, I watched a podcast the other day, and it was more like a TED talk, but they were talking about an experiment they did. This couple decided to go completely smart technology for an entire month. So they made their home, their refrigerator, their bed, everything into this smart technology. And one of the striking things they said is, like, they have a smart toothbrush and they have to talk to their toothbrush. And it's like, to what extent is this, like, too much? Like,
I don't think your toothbrush needs to talk to you. What does it have to say?
It's just like, good morning, toothbrush. Please turn on. Like, what are you doing? So
I guess it's like you need to brush more. You're supposed to brush for 2 minutes or something.
And does it yell at you? Like,
why does it need to be smart to do that, though? Like, why do they need that data on how much I'm brushing my teeth, you know?
Well, in 2015, they, there's this company called Beam. It's a toothbrush company, and they have smart toothbrushes that monitor, like, your amount and, like, how rigorous you're brushing your teeth, and you get discounts on, like, premiums for, like, you know, your dentist's office. And it's just sort of like, why do they need this information? I have no idea.
That freaks me out a little bit.
Yeah.
I mean, it goes way beyond that too. You know, smart refrigerators, smart thermostats. But something with the smart toothbrush really bugs me, because, you know, are your dental insurance premiums going to start getting adjusted based on, you know, if you have a smart toothbrush, then you get a discount on your insurance? it's pretty invasive. We can laugh at it here, but that's kind of scary and dystopian.
No, it absolutely is. And then there, I was thinking about this a lot too. It's when you have, like, you know, these smart doorbells or smart locks, like, how easy is it for other people to hack as well? So it's like, yeah, you are protected in this new smart technology way, but those companies have your information. Like, I don't know. Maybe I'm just like a conspiracy. I don't know. I just feel like that's very unsafe. Like, I want that physical key and lock. Like, I want to turn my door. I don't like to, like, just punch in my numbers.
Yeah, my house has that too, and it freaks me out. Like, we have a 4-digit code to get in, like, no key. And I'm like, as soon as someone figures it out, like, there we go. Mm-hmm. Like, that's a breach into our house.
Mm-hmm. Phoebe, how many tries does it, like, how many times can you mess up before you're, like, locked out?
Like, 4. So that's gone off many times. And they're hard to get into. You have to, like, pull them and then put it, yeah. No, it's annoying.
Do you know if it's, like, smart? Is it connected to something, or is it just digital?
I don't know if it's connected to the police or if it's just, like, their... I need to look into that, actually. I don't know. That's, yeah, I don't even know where it goes to. I just know that it starts, like, ringing and my roommates get mad at me.
We don't know, so,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, exactly. I think that brings up a big point of, like, we don't know, and to what extent do, like, we care? So there's obviously we're sitting up here talking about how it's scary, and we're joking about it, but there is sort of a criticism by older generations about how we just accept that our data is being used, and it's just an inevitable thing. So I guess how much do we think that that's true? Even though we're sitting up here, are we still using like our smart locks at home? Are we still using our computers and Netflix and all these other digital mediums in order to have like convenience and entertainment?
That's actually a very interesting point, saying like we constantly, if we get this benefit, and I know that we've mentioned this before, but if we are getting some sort of benefit out of the deal, then we sort of don't have an issue with giving out our information, because we're like, well, you know, I pay, you know, $10 or whatever for Netflix a month, and they have all this information, and they can watch, like, my binge watching, like, they'll collect that data. Like, it's just sort of like, I don't know, how much Breaking Bad can I actually watch and not get judged? I don't know.
Well, that's, the trade-off between, the convenience and this kind of expectation we have that with all of these services, that we're getting something in exchange for our data. But that data turns around and has some value on its own. You know, we're paying for our Netflix, but Netflix is using that data for other things. And Shana, didn't you have something about the cost of data?
Oh, yeah. I'm a TED Talk connoisseur, basically. I watch like 3 or 4 a day, but I was watching another TED Talk, and they were saying about how, like, 10 years ago, our data was worth about $150, like, per person. Like, you know, in, like, today's money, that's really not anything anyways. But now, it's worth less than, like, $1. Like, because we just so freely give it out constantly that there's no, right to our, self anymore. Like, it's just sort of, like, everybody has their information anyways. And
supply and demand, you know, right? And
exactly,
there's more supply.
No,
the price comes down.
It's very interesting. And then I was reading an article about, I'm an avid online shopper. Like, I like going to the store, too, but, like, online shopping, like, I can do that, like, in my bed. Like, you know, and
but
I was
like, you don't know if it fits.
Well, I mean, they can return it.
I know, but I don't
Amazon wardrobe, yo.
Yeah.
Well, mostly, like, what I buy online is, like, you know,
like, you know it's going to
fit. Like, I know
sure.
It's going to fit.
How,
like,
do you know, though?
I've worn the same size Levi's for, like, 20
years. You just know. But I was reading this article, and it was talking about sort of, like, because I was interested in the dynamic between, like, whether or not, like, older generations and younger generations, like, trust the internet more not, or, like, things like that. Like, to what extent is this, like, gap? And this article says that the privacy of, like, you know, online shopping, putting your information, does not have, like, a gap in between generations. It says, with younger and older shoppers alike revealing concerns about this issue, the research reveals that 28% of 18 to 44-year-olds don't like the idea of stores retaining information about them, such as shopping habits and previous purchases. So, like, if you walk into a Kato and they, like, keep that information. But, wow, 36% of 45 to 54-year-olds also, like, share the same concern, but when it comes to online shopping, it's completely different. So it's just sort of, like, this interesting, like, why is it different if I go to a physical store and they have my information versus, you know, Zaful has my information stored? Like, I don't know if there's, like, a interface change there.
Maybe, like, I mean, you have to fill out a form to, like, join the, you know, Harris Teeter, Dick Club, or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
Do you think, like, making it explicit like that really triggers something versus online shopping where you just kind of click through some terms of service?
I think it's very interesting. I mean, we've mentioned, you know, or we've heard so many times who actually reads these terms of services, but when you're actually having to sign and show your ID for a Harris Teeter Vic card, it's sort of like, why do you need my ID?
Yeah, I feel like you're definitely more hesitant to do something in person. Also, I read something recently that if you use a credit card, like, you should get your receipt, because then it's like you're holding, like you're getting something physically back for, like, what you purchased. Because so often, like, when we use credit cards, like, we don't think about it. Oh, that was really off topic.
I don't think it's off topic. I definitely do that every time I make a purchase.
Mm-hmm.
Because I want to double check it and I want physical proof that that's exactly what I spent, just because you're giving so much information out when you hand over a credit card, be that physically at like a restaurant or, you know, whether you put that online. And yeah, I really, going back to Netflix, I saw this interesting article on USA Today that was talking about just like how much information is stored in Netflix. So you give them your credit card information, you give them your ID, you give them so many identifying information, and then they get to store your watch history, how much you watch TV, etc., etc. And then if you read the terms of service, it talks about how they do protect your service or your information, except sometimes when it is necessary for a third party or limited third parties or necessary for like legal something, police purposes, and then it says, but it's protected. So it's like, or that's limited. So it's like, we don't read these things, we just click through them. And yet Netflix, the service that most of us have, and it serves like, I think this article said, like 118 million users, has so much
and
then
probably 5 times that, because we all share a Netflix.
Yeah.
Exactly. That's very true.
Well, that's kind of brings up an interesting point about these loopholes and in these terms of service and how your data can be used
mm-hmm.
by these private companies. And I think there's a lot of, I definitely have kind of a bias towards like not wanting the government to have too much data on me, but you know, kind of not really thinking too hard about what private companies are doing with their data. And that kind of brings up a Netflix-specific couple of clips here that talk about the way a private company like Netflix will share our anonymous, quote-unquote, data versus how government anonymizes our data. Shana, would you play that for us, please?
Yeah. Wait, hold on. Is this one labeled yours, or is this the...
Yeah, this is David Clip.
Okay.
MP3.
Sorry.
Now, use of data in this way is allowed as long as we redact the personally identifiable information. But by removing PII, we drastically limit the data's usefulness, and we don't always protect identities. For example, if Karen lived on a small street, her identity could easily be revealed just by sharing her age and street name. NIST scientists are seeking ways to improve the sharing of data while protecting individual identities through measurement and evaluation. By slightly altering personal information, for example, Karen's age or home address, we reduce the risk of compromising privacy while still allowing data to be shared.
Netflix, of course, anonymized this dataset by removing the names of users and by replacing some ratings with fake and random ratings. Even though that sounds pretty anonymous, it actually wasn't. Two computer scientists from the University of Texas published a paper in 2008 and said that they had successfully identified people from this dataset by combining them with data from IMDb.
So those went really, really fast. But the first clip there was from...
I thought you did that on purpose.
National Institutes of... we'll fix it in post. that first clip there was from the National Institutes of Standards and Technology, and it was talking about how personally identifying information has to, by law, be removed from any public disclosure of any data the government collects, whether that's the Census Bureau or the monthly unemployment statistics or anything from the CDC or anything like that. Whereas the second clip's talking about Netflix, and they're just anonymizing, quote unquote, your data and throwing it out there and having a competition for people to predict your watching habits. But at the same time, computer scientists are going in there and taking this anonymized information, matching it to another source, and are able to identify specific individuals based on Netflix data. And that kind of weirds me out a little bit. Netflix can just kind of throw it up there, say it's anonymous, but that was from 2008. They could reverse engineer that 12 years ago. But it's like nearly impossible to get your hands on individual level government data.
Well, it's also like a very like scary thought to think about, that like an innocent action is watching TV, like binge watching these, like, you know, like I binge watch criminal shows all the time, and it's just sort of like, how, what are they deducing from my behavior? Like, I have, you know, it's just sort of like, I promise I'm sane. Like, I just like to know. And it also brings up this like interesting dynamic between like, yeah, we are in the government, or like the government can or may not have this like information anonymized, but it's like when it goes beyond that, like when it takes another step, like when it no longer becomes anonymized, like when they can do that reverse engineering. And it's just sort of like, I was watching something about these automatic license plate readers that police use, and it's just like, and I've never even thought that this was a thing, but they're like boxes that are like put on like street posts and like all around, you know, the United States basically. And it's just these like very simple, like they read every single car that passes by them. And sometimes like it's just being compared, depending on like what city you're in, like to a watch list, but sometimes like that information's never deleted. So it's like every single car that passed by this particular automatic license plate reader can tell like when that person was there, like when and like why they were there, like could be maybe possibly deduced. And it's just like a weird thing to think about.
I think that gets into like a question though that we haven't really discussed, of like, what about when these data collections or serve like purposes. So like in that case, like it can catch criminals. It can, like, I've always wondered personally, like when they put out APBs like on specific license plates, like what does that mean? Like you have some cops looking at it, but you assume that what everyday citizens are looking at it, I'm surely not looking at people's license plates saying, oh, you know, I saw them on the news. So it's interesting that they have these services where you have like these automatic license plate readers, and it's used to catch people, and that's important. And then we also think about other services, not like Echo or Alexa, that have caught criminals also by listening to people. And so like what are the benefits, and then what are the costs with these specific devices that have solved criminal cases, and we kind of appreciate that, so we don't have people running around.
Yeah,
that,
I think that's a really
interesting
point you bring up, and it kind of goes to the what's public versus what's private.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're out driving around in your car, can you really expect that your license plate that's, you know, on the outside of your car on a public road is private information? But if you have an Amazon Echo or a Google Home or, you know, something like that, that's in your home. That's something that's, you know, traditionally been considered private space.
Mm-hmm.
How, you know, if you get caught on a camera in a public park murdering somebody, that's, you know, that's not a very private place to be murdering somebody. But in your home, this is going way off the rails.
You're
even though you shouldn't.
Well, it sort of brings up this like ethical component, like this data that is being collected. Like if humans, like itself, like take the liberty to like process this data, it's not just like, you know, these automatic license plate readers sending, you know, like flashes of warning. Like somebody has to be on the other side to like process that, and it's just sort of, it gives it sort of like a human intelligence component to it as well, which makes me, like, when I think about police, like, you know, security, it makes me feel a little bit better that, like, I know that, like, somebody else like that is human and who has human qualities and considerations, like, has to process that, like, maybe incriminating evidence. Like, we're not sure. But it also, like, there's also a flip side to that as well. In another TED Talk, they were talking about, like, instances where the NYPD will drive by mosques around, like, the 2001, you know, terrorist attack with, like, this technology to see who's attending these services. And, like, to me, that's, like, crossing the line. It's sort of, like, a malintent motivation there. And just, like, finding anything to incriminate somebody based on their religion, like, that's, to me, in, like, a way over the line. And I'm not sure, like, how to process that either.
Well, I 100% agree, and the NYPD was, you know, actually sued and settled out of court because they know they would have lost. And that kind of goes again to, sorry to, you know, beat this horse, but the government is doing something wrong there, and we have legal protections. They're not, you know, you have to have resources to assert your legal rights for sure, and that's a whole different conversation, a whole nother dimension to whether you can, you know, have the financial access to protect your rights. But we do have protections about government data and surveillance like that. We have pretty weak protections against what you know, Amazon can collect on us. When you plug in your Alexa and turn it on for the first time, you're agreeing implicitly to the terms of service. You have to click through on your device, but what recourse do you have against Amazon? There's no the Fourth Amendment, the 14th Amendment that doesn't govern Amazon.
Well, this comes up to an interesting point that Mariana has about, like, social media and, like, maybe this difference between, like, if you're famous and not famous, like, is there a line drawn there? Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah. All right, so there's, like, a lot of influencers rising, like, the whole YouTube thing, a lot of rappers. And so in January, there was a rapper known as DaBaby who shoved a hotel employee into a chair and was, like, scolding him very aggressively. And, like, the video just went viral. Everyone started judging him. It was like, why, and why? And so then a month later, last month, a rapper known as Pop Smoke released his location at a hotel that he was staying at, and he ended up being, well, no, not at a hotel he was staying at, it was his home, and he was actually murdered after exposing his location accidentally on social media. And so then it made people think, like, back to, like, the baby's actions, because he was with his daughter at the time, and he spoke out about it, like, you're putting my daughter's life in danger by trying to, like, publicize these pictures and these videos of me with my daughter. And so then it, like, became understandable of, like, what his actions were. So that was, like, a big, like, privacy aspect when it comes to, like, influencers and rappers. Like, do they actually, like, need privacy, because things can escalate pretty quickly.
It comes up to, like, an interesting point. There was somebody talking, or not somebody, but the Twitter representative that does PR was talking about how Twitter, as a choice, decided to delete all of the geo data that was associated with pictures. Like, because when you upload, like, a picture of, like, a random cat that's in your house, that's not just showing a picture of a cat in a house, that's showing, like, the exact apartment in the exact city of the exact state where you are. You're, like, your GPS coordinates are exactly directed. And so Twitter, as a whole, decided, like, we're going to erase all of that geo data. Like, you can't, like, put locations, and, like, even if you try to, like, tweet at, like, or, like, some, like, hate crime or something and, like, put somebody's address, like, it will automatically delete it, because it's just, you know, they're very, very trying to be protective of people's locations. And especially if you accidentally say, like, this is where I am and you're famous, like,
you
never know. I mean, even if you're not famous, like, if you have a stalker or, like, any type of, like, somebody with malintent against you, it's just terrifying.
Mm-hmm. I think that goes, not to hate on Netflix again, even though that seems like a theme of our talk today. Like, they get information on your IP addresses. They know what devices you're using to stream. Like, there's, I mean, that's location. That's, even though we think nothing about
that. I've kicked people off of my Netflix account. Like, can't use this anymore.
Well, see, that's the thing. Like, they know that you're sharing because they can see how many IP addresses, and they're different, and they can see different locations. And so, I mean, as, you know, she was saying, like, Shauna was saying, like, it's not private, and anyone with malintent can use that information. And
and even when we do make, like, our social media private, it's like, how private is it? And there was a clip. Can you play that one clip where this one dude was talking? Yeah, that one.
Only as private as your most public friend, because there's nothing to say that that person isn't going to tag you in something you don't want to be tagged in, or even take your content and share it on their network, even if that means screenshotting it. What the paper really goes on to say is that privacy is now an illusion in a networked world. So it really is only as private as the network you keep. And
so that just shows, like, even though your account is private, if your friend's account is public.
Yeah. And screenshots, like, anything can be screenshotted.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't matter. Yeah, that's scary.
Yeah, it's like Snapchat says, we'll tell you if it's screenshot, but, like, what can you do at that point?
Yeah,
now what? You know that your privacy is being violated, but now what are you going to do? But I think that also brings up an interesting point just about Snapchat is, like, people think that it's an app that gives you privacy because it deletes your messages after you send them, but, like,
nothing's ever deleted.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Again, that's what's public and what's private. That's something that's increasingly unclear, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I think that does it for this week's episode.
We'll fix it in the post.
Thanks for pointing out exactly one private company that did one good thing one time, Shauna.
You're welcome, guys.
Great. Nice job, guys. Very cool.